Welcome on back to another Meet Kevin Report. It is July 21st, and I think we're actually a little bit further here on the Meet Kevin Report. We're on 128, I believe, today. Let me change that and fix that title really quickly. Anyway, welcome aboard. Thank you so much for being here. So I want to actually really start with this this bear piece, which it's been pretty tough to find bear pieces, and I want to talk a little bit about that because I think it's pretty wild and kind of telling for what's actually going on in the economy out there. So let me quickly double check this, and then we'll be good to talk about exactly that, as well as what's going on here. Okay, sorry about that. I messed up the titling, but that's actually just my fault for not paying attention to the date. Yep, okay, we're good. All right, perfect. So we are on episode 128. Perfect. Okay, so let's get right into this. Usually when I make YouTube videos, one of the things I love is having the perspective of bear pieces so that I can evaluate what do I think is going on in the world around me, how do people feel about the economy, how do consumers act, how are consumers spending, what's going on with businesses, incomes, and expenditures everywhere around me. And I like to take that information and then compare it to what I see in earnings reports at companies. Then I like to read bullish reports and I like to read bearish reports. Basically, I try to read everything that I can about what's going on in the economy. As of about the last, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks here, ever since TS Lombard flipped, there's been a really big change. And it's a big flip-flop that I'd like to talk about because I find it quite interesting, potentially also important. But remember T.S. Lombard's flip-flop. First of all, in case you don't remember, T.S. Lombard, the way you have to look at them is as a bear. They've pretty much consistently written bear pieces for the last 2 years. And what's remarkable is just about a month ago, they flipped. And how did they flip? Well, you might remember they wrote a bear piece and said, we're bearish, but we're going to go neutral on stocks. In other words, we're going to increase our allocation to stocks because stocks might go up. In other words, T.S. Lombard's like, we don't think the Fed could stick a soft landing, and we're really big bears. We think inflation is going to continue. There'll be a second wave of inflation. Commodities are going to boom. Rates are going to stay higher for longer. We're all screwed, basically. But we're flipping because stocks might actually go up. Now, after that moment, I've noticed it's been extremely difficult anywhere to find really bearish information from people. Mostly because it feels like every day somebody else is flipping. And now this, on one hand, sounds really great. Because it means if everybody's flipping from being a bear to actually being positive about the market, then eventually we should start seeing even substantially more allocation to the stock market and a rising stock market, which I suppose if we look at the NASDAQ and just take a pause there and a breather for a moment, oh wait, that's exactly what's been happening. It's the Nike swoosh, which is something we've been talking about for about a year and a half now. And the reason it works is because not all bears capitulate at once. They slowly roll off, and then as they roll off, they realize they are underweight equities, and they allocate to various different stocks and companies, and they become less bearish. And as they become less bearish, they don't immediately go from, you know, let's say 10% stocks to 100% stocks, but they slowly rotate that dial to allocated rather than underallocated. And that's actually what we've seen in not just the NASDAQ rising, but also, I mean, you could see NVIDIA's meteoric rise here. Beyond NVIDIA's meteoric rise, we could look at the DJX as well, Dow Jones Industrial Index. That's been a little bit more stuck, but as of what recently, it's also starting to rise. Let's look at the SPY. Same thing. So every index we look at, even the Dow, which has been a little bit slow, picked up yesterday where the NASDAQ took a little breather. And so even though we're going to take a little piece, look at a bit of a bear piece here on debt, billions in corporate debt coming due, even though we're going to look at what is maybe a big take on a bearish piece, I wanted to start this video out by arguing it's getting increasingly difficult to find a contra argument to where the economy is going, which seems to be a relatively soft landing. Maybe if there was a recession, a super minor recession, with most employers seeking to retain their employees and essentially supporting spending through any kind of recession that we might face, which could really be base effect based. But that's a way of saying that, like, hey, even if we're just like 0.1% slower of an economy than we were last year, we're still technically in a recession, which I always find very weird that you could have such a massive run-up. And then the fact that we didn't already go substantially negative after that crazy spending we had during 2021 blows my mind, but whatever. So let's take a look at this. Here's a Bloomberg bear piece. Mind you, it's so hard to find bear pieces these days. And look, you've got like a lightning bolt striking a building. It's supposed to appear scary. Anyway, it talks about this $500 billion corporate debt storm building over the global economy. And on a daily basis, I'm seeing more and more talk about corporate debt. Now, what I'd like to do is first mention that yesterday I was reading a front page story on the Wall Street Journal that was talking about one of the reasons the consumer has been so resilient is because they actually took advantage of consolidating their personal debt during the pandemic. So they have less personal debt than they did going into the recovery after the pandemic, which is one of the reasons, potentially, the consumers continue to spend. So the consumer's been okay. So if we can't talk bearishly about the consumer, maybe we have to talk bearishly about corporate debt. See, corporate debt is an interesting one, because if we look at corporate debt, we think, okay, well, this would be bad, right? I mean, like a massive amount of corporate debt could end up destroying companies and leading to bankruptcy, right? Maybe when you're going into a bearish market, but not when you're looking at what Carvana just pulled off. Consider for a moment what Carvana just pulled off. Carvana was literally about 6 months ago defaulting on their debt. That is step one to bankruptcy. Textbook bankruptcy. You stop making payments. Can't afford to actually pay your debt holders. That's where Carvana was 6 months ago. Fast forward to today, Carvana gave 80% of their bondholders a middle finger and said, we are writing you off and we're not paying you anymore. Suck it, basically. Extinguished about $400 million of corporate interest expense. And now their stock's gone from $3 to $46. Like, what is that? I don't know, 15x or something like that? It's insane. And they did that by being able to middle finger off the debt holder. So even stories where you have corporations that are like, they're going bankrupt, they're not even making their payments anymore, somehow have been able to survive. Maybe it's all driven by insane liquidity reserves that still exist, either at companies or with consumers, or maybe because the stock market has recovered, it's able to prop up zombie companies. Or maybe Carvana has truly turned it around and maybe they're unique. But it's fascinating nonetheless. And so it's worth going into this Bloomberg big take and remembering that all of these super bearish things so far just haven't really come to fruition. I mean, a couple more things. Banking crisis, it's basically a nothing burger. And that was like scary when that was going on. Not only that, but what about the liquidity crisis? Oh, as expected, the buffer of the Fed repo facility is filling the Treasury General's coffers again. And now people are literally punching the air in real life. Like, Kevin, see, this is the air punch. What is going on? Did you see that our debt is already up another $1 trillion? What is this, man? Our country's been mismanaged. It's just supposed to crash. And it's like, all the bears are literally pissed off in real life too. Like, how is this possible? How can Carvana survive? How can the country continue to expand its debt like this? And all of these crises that we're supposed to have end up not happening. Leads to very unhappy bears. Anyway, let's try to touch a little bit of a bear piece here. Let's just say, you know, there's still plenty of ways to build your wealth, specifically with the Zero Millionaire Real Estate Investing Course, the How to Make More Money and Get SH9T Done Faster, and of course the Stocks and Psych Group, all very popular bundle right now, linked down below. You can email us at staff@meetkevin.com if you want some more insight into those, or just go to meetkevin.com to check them out. You can join me daily in the course member live streams. We'll have some new lectures coming out as well soon. So, a $500 billion corporate debt storm builds over the global economy. Concerns of a credit crisis have receded, but a wave of corporate bankruptcies is building now that an era of easy money has come to an end. Yes, of course. They're all going to go bankrupt. Okay. You're going to see a lot of defaults. It feels different from the prior cycle because other companies might not be able to withstand the debt burden they have and will either choose to default or restructure, which could really hurt the economy should many of these occur at the same time. Well, maybe, maybe not. See, bankruptcies are actually a beautiful thing. They take bad ideas and they delete them. They take people who are working for inefficient companies and they say, hey, you're working for a company that's not that efficient. Would you mind going and finding another job? See, I made that all like 2023-ish. It's really more like, we're going bankrupt, you're laid off. And you're like, oh, shit, I lost my job. And you go find something else, and you're like, oh, I got a better job. Oh, this place is better anyway. That's capitalism, right? That's the whole point. You're supposed to see bad companies go bankrupt. The fact that we actually haven't seen more bad companies go bankrupt via corporate bankruptcies or restructuring or whatever, blows my mind. Anyway, continuing. So here's an individual just talking about this $500 billion storm of corporate debt distress that's already starting to make a landfall, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. The tally is all but certain to grow, okay? And that's deepening worries on Wall Street by threatening to slow economic growth and strain credit markets just emerging from the deepest losses in decades, okay? On the surface, much of it looks like the usual churn of capitalism, of companies undermined by forces like technological change or the rise of remote work that emptied office buildings. See, that's kind of what my impression was. Yet underneath the surface, there's deeper, more troubling info. Debt loads have swelled during an era of unusually cheap money, and now that's a heavier burden as central banks ratchet up interest rates. I mean, we've heard this one for quite a while, but okay, all right, whatever. Total outstanding corporate bonds and loans trading at distressed levels exceed $590 billion. Okay, so let's touch on that for a moment. The innovation, dare I say, of the corporate bond is actually quite brilliant. Because think about a corporate bond for a moment. You go to a corporation and you say, hey, look, this is you right here. Let's draw like this. Oh, dear Lord. Okay. That's our problem. Oh, okay. Here we go. All right. This is you. Okay. That's you. And this right here is the paper mill. Okay. So that's the factory. You're going to give $1,000 to the factory. And the company is going to give you an IOU, which is a promise to repay, right? So they're going to give you a promise to repay. But they're also going to give you potentially some form of coupon book where you could redeem your, you know, quarterly bond payment or whatever. That's your yield, right? When you paid $1,000, maybe you signed up to get a 4% yield. So you're getting $40 a year. Congratulations. Here's your coupon. And maybe you could redeem that at $10 a quarter. Okay, great. So what's happened now, though, is as we've gone into turbulent times, these corporations are still responsible for paying this $1,000 plus $40. But what freaks people out is that these securities right here, these bonds, these IOUs, are able to be traded on the public market. So you go to like the New York Stock Exchange and you're able to say, hey, you know what? Look, I have this $1,000 bond here and I need liquidity because I want to buy a boat. And you bring it to the New York Stock Exchange, and the New York Stock Exchange is like, for that company, bro, I'll buy it from you for $700. And because it's a public market, we see that as a fair price for what you paid. You took a 30% haircut, cha-ching, you exchange it. Somebody else got it at a newly marked fair value, and you walk away with a 30% discount, but you still go buy your boat because you had enough anyway. So now all of a sudden, what does that mean when Bloomberg goes and writes a story? Well, Bloomberg goes and writes a story and it says, oh, hey, we just saw corporate bonds fall 30%. Meanwhile, you look over here and the company's like, well, that didn't affect us because that was traded on the secondary market. And the person, you, is like, well, I don't care, whatever, man. So I got a little bit less back, but I still got my boat. So in other words, in my opinion, when we're looking at these debt reports and we're looking at something like this right here, outstanding corporate debt trading at distressed levels, who cares? To some extent, it doesn't really matter where it's trading. It's just trading at distressed levels because the bond market still thinks we're going into a recession. But there are plenty of people actually buying the dip on these bonds because they have this impression that, well, if we actually stick a soft landing, these will actually recover quite well. And when you go bring that $1,000 coupon to the stock market for, you know, now you, like, if you took a coupon or a bond for Carvana that was originally $1,000 to the New York Stock Exchange in November, maybe you'd get $10 for it. Like, they were written down like nothing. Now, go bring it to the New York Stock Exchange, you might get $800 for it, right? Like, it's massively increased in value. So there's a buy the dip opportunity in these bonds as well for companies that just don't end up going bankrupt, somehow end up surviving. So really just measuring how much de-stress there is in like corporate bonds doesn't really matter if people are taking advantage of the free market anyway. I mean, think about it. Like, you could have literally said that last year, the stock market went through a 40% level of de-stress as everything got written down 20 to 40%, right? It's the same thing. It's just an instrument that's traded freely. Anyway, the rising tide of de-stress is, of course, to a certain degree by design. Caught by surprise as inflation has surged, monetary policymakers have been aggressively draining cash. Inevitably, this means some companies will fall. The pockets of corporate credit look particularly vulnerable to the ballooning debt. In the U.S., the amount of high-yield bonds and leveraged loans, which are owned by riskier, less creditworthy businesses, has more than doubled from 2008 to $3 trillion in 2021, before the Federal Reserve started its steepest hikes in over a generation. A lot of those securities will need to be repaid in the next few years, contributing to a $785 billion wall of debt that's coming due. False. A lot of the securities don't have to be repaid. But that's the thing. Like, if the company goes bankrupt, then the securities don't get repaid. And then people are like, oh, but then the company's bankrupt. So? Maybe it was supposed to go bankrupt. But that means that money doesn't necessarily have to be repaid. On the other hand, some of those companies will just go, middle finger, baby, we saw what Carvana did, we will do that too. Or you'll end up going to court and you get, you know, maybe a little bit more of a left-leaning judge who's like, even though you have secured bonds, given that some of those against Carvana were deemed unsecured, we'll just assume y'all are willing to take a negotiated haircut and prevent the company from going into bankruptcy via Chapter 7 liquidation, and we'll just restructure the company, negotiating even your secured debt down with a 50% haircut. And then boom, guess what? You get a judge that's like $785 billion wall of debt is now half of that. It ain't that big of a deal anymore. It's crazy. I feel myself sitting here going, it just can't be. There's not enough bad news to talk about. That must be good. But then on the other hand, what are we missing? Because the more I look at bad news, it's just not that bad. Or it ends up working out. I know we got the Teamsters Union and UPS and, you know, some near-term drama. We still got the weed issue with Ukraine. We've got China's economy massively slowing down. People are like, oh, don't worry, there'll be war with Taiwan and China. Don't see that happening at all unless they really want to destroy their economy and really solidify the fact that they're not going to be a manufacturing base in the future. There's no way in hell China's going to go for that. Look, they like to hold on to power, but I don't want to give it away either. Let's keep going. With cooling growth in China and Europe, the Fed expected to continue raising rates, those repayments may be too much for some businesses to bear. In America alone, the pile of troubled bonds and loans has already surged over 360% since 2021. Ooh. If the spread continues, it could lead to the first broad-based cycle of defaults since the great financial crisis. Bring it on, man. It's like an elastic band. You could get away with a certain amount of tension, but there will be a point where it snaps. See, these make such good, like, clicky arguments in these news pieces. It's like, yes, something's going to destroy, and then I'll finally get my chance to buy cheap real estate and cheap stocks. False. And that's the pisser, right? I think there are a lot of people who are like, Kevin, I want to buy real estate. I want to buy stocks, but I'm looking and I'm going, what the hell? Dude, I thought stocks were supposed to be a good deal, like, because we're in like a recessionary time or whatever. And I thought I was going to be able to get a chance to buy real estate cheap, and I just can't get anything, right? That's what a lot of people are very frustrated about. Now, I'm not worried, for example, for the real estate startup, but I have a very unique position in that. In any market we're in, I know I could get phenomenal deals below market value. So it's absolutely possible you could do it as well. You just have to know what to look for and how to handle it. It's construction arbitrage. Anyway, that's already starting to happen with 120 bankruptcies so far in the U.S. alone this year. How many have you really heard of? I mean, are we talking like crypto bankruptcies here? Like companies that really matter? Or are these companies that have been going bankrupt, we're like, yeah, well, we kind of saw that one coming. And even the companies that are filing bankruptcy aren't necessarily going to go to liquidation either. Anyway, even so, less than 15% of the nearly $600 billion of debt trading at distressed levels have actually defaulted. Bingo. Exactly. Look at that. Even though that debt is, like, that they just shot themselves in the foot with the article. I at least they're being transparent here about that. But it's kind of what I was saying earlier with, like, who cares if it's trading for a lower level? That doesn't really mean anything. And now we find out what only 15% of that distressed debt is actually not being fulfilled. So going back to this picture right here, when you have this bond from this company, this IOU, default is when they stop paying you your $40 every year. But only 15% of companies in this situation have actually defaulted. Huh. It's just not that bad.
Okay,
great. Moody's said the default rate for speculative-grade companies worldwide is expected to hit 5.1% next year, up from 3.8% last year. Ooh! And under the pessimistic scenario, oh, okay, it could go as high as 13.7%, exceeding the level reached during 2008-2009. The other thing to consider is that, you know, this is sort of a flip side argument. I'm not saying it's definitely not going to be a big deal. I'm just saying so far it's a pretty weak argument. And I get it. Yeah. Oh, under the most pessimistic scenario, you're going to tempt me by saying it's going to be worse than 2008 and 2009. Well, first of all, that assumes that your pessimistic scenario is going to be correct. And second of all, is it though? Because think about it. Today, we're in this really weird environment where the rich really get richer. The big companies make the most money. And so the speculative smaller companies matter less to the economy than the big companies do. Apple today is way more of a Goliath than it was in 2008 when they were releasing the App Store for the iPhone. Yeah, who here remembers that? When I had the iPhone 1 in 2007, it didn't come with an App Store. There was no flashlight app. You had to open your stupid camera, go to video, and press light. At least there was no light sensor to know if it was like bright or dark, so you could turn the light on even in bright areas. But anyway, yeah, I mean, Apple was way smaller in 2008. There wasn't even an iPad. I mean, my children don't even know a world that didn't have an iPad Pro. So, it's just we're in a little bit of a different environment. The economy, for one, has remained surprisingly resilient in the face of high borrowing costs. Yes. Yield spreads in the U.S. junk bond market, a key measure of perceived risk, have narrowed since March. Huh. Interesting. In other words, people are buying the dip on these junk bonds. So understand that for a moment. People are literally doing this. They're going over here and going, oh, you're willing to sell that bond for a 30% discount on that trash company? while inflation is going down and it looks like we're trending towards a soft landing, yes, I'll buy that dip. And the more they're buying this dip, the more these bonds actually recover. It's crazy. Okay? Because remember, the more you buy, and this I know gets confusing, so let me add this in. The more people buy the junk, the lower the yield goes on the junk. And so if quality debt is trading for 5%, let's say, and junk debt is trading for 10%, that's a spread of 500 basis points, right? Well, if a bunch of people buy the junk and the yield on the junk goes down to 8% and treasuries on the 2-year say 5%, now you have a 300 basis point spread. So that's yields compressing. Okay, cool. So the more defaults rise, the more investors and banks pull back on lending. Right, well, this is the, like the credit squeeze argument, but so far we're not seeing that. In fact, we're seeing like the opposite. More people are buying the dip on these bonds because they want a higher yield, especially after Carvana. It is more than one point, okay, who is this? All right, here's the Canary Wharf Group. Who cares about the Canary Wharf Group? Who cares? Literally, who cares? I mean, listen to this. That's fallen particularly hard on the Canary Wharf. Two buildings owned by Chinese property developer Cheng K Group were taken over by receivers after loan payments weren't made. In June came more bad news. HSBC said it's planning to leave by late 2026, who was an occupant of this Canary Wharf Group. The developer, whose credit rating has been cut deep into junk as vacancy rates rise. It has more than $1.4 billion of debt coming due in 2024 and 2025. Who cares, though? Okay, so some office buildings are going bankrupt. Guess what? The buildings don't collapse. Somebody takes a haircut on their debt. The building still has equity in it to some extent. I mean, think about it. If you have a $100 million building and now it's worth $50 million, well, the debt on it was probably only $60 million. So some bondholder gets burned by $10 million. The person who loses most is the person or entity that owned the equity, you know, the 100 to 60 part. So they get wiped out. Who cares? Chang whatever and his Canary Wharf Group dissolve. Nobody cares. Like, you don't wake up going, oh, the Canary Wharf Group is going bankrupt. Wharf Group. Sorry, I started watching Game of Thrones and all this direwolf talking is getting to me. But anyway, nobody cares. And oh no, you know, the bondholders had to take a little haircut. Okay. But again, they're not looking at what is the part of the debt that's actually a risk. They're just saying, well, all, you know, $60 million is at risk, even though there's a big equity buffer in real estate to where it's really only the top edge of the debt that's at risk, right? I mean, picture that. Just to draw you a picture. Here's a building. It's worth $100 million. It's got $60 million in debt. Now the value of the building falls all the way down to $50 million. Okay, who lost most of the money? Well, the investor did. The original building owner, the equity holder. The equity holder lost all the money. The bondholder only lost $10 million. But Bloomberg's telling you, oh no, all $60 million is at risk. Shut up. It's just nonsense. Anyway, continue. All right. What else? All right, the buyout machine. Private equity firms have thrived on easy credit. That often left companies deeply indebted, frequently with floating rate loans. Fine. Soured PE-backed companies account for more than $50 billion of distressed debt. KKR has a distressed portfolio company, you know, whatever. Blackstone's in here, Apollo Global Management, Carlyle Group. A lot of these are office buildings. Who cares? It's the same thing as Global Wharf I just talked about. Okay, meanwhile, rates jumped, brewing troubles. One of the biggest U.S. radio station owners, Audacity, has more than $800 million of debt due next year. And in May, the S&P slashed the company's rating into junk. Am I going to wake up tomorrow sad that Audacity isn't here anymore? I don't even know who that is. I'm sure some people will be sad their radio station isn't there anymore. But guess what? Then you open the Twitter app and oh my gosh, wow. There's plenty of stuff for you to listen to or YouTube or whatever. So again, whatever. So there you go. There's what is, you know, an example of a scary big take of disaster and hell and a title of a $500 billion corporate debt storm builds over the global economy. And then you throw some realism in there and you're like, damn, time to close my shorts. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something. And trust me, I would love to go give me some juicy bear stuff, because I want to talk about it. A, because I want to know if I'm mispositioned. If there's some juicy bear stuff, I want to be able to go to you and go, look at this juicy bear stuff, for two reasons. One, I want to be, look at this juicy bear stuff, and it's right, and I'm selling. Right? Because I don't want to get screwed. Nobody wants to get screwed. So I want to tell you about it. But the second reason is I want some juicy bear stuff, so then we can share stuff here, and then more people are like, oh gosh, we got to pay attention to this issue, and we get to hang out more. I mean, that's just, it's the way business works, right? If there's no bad news, I'm just going to sit here with a cup of coffee and go, another great day. That's boring. But unfortunately, that just is the reality of what's going on right now. Now, I look at these, the bear pieces, the worst place I found for bear pieces. I can't believe I even looked, but I looked at some bear pieces on YouTube and I'm like, the stringing together of other utter nonsense is crazy. I mean, you literally, the leftover bears are having to do the, y'all been to a grocery store? Bad, ain't it? Yeah. Now, see that headline? $500 billion corporate debt storm. Mm-hmm. You think you can buy a house or a car with 7.5% interest rates? Yeah. Election coming up. You think the banking crisis is over? Just getting started. Mm-hmm. Buy some gold. Like, that's what I get. I'm like, what the hell is this? This is utter trash. Sorry. I'm sorry. I let's go listen to Sarah Eisen. I can't handle this anymore.
Balance, was it the 44% run-up year to date in the triple Qs? Was it disappointing earnings? Was it rising yields? Yes, all of the above, right? So we had a bad day, and the question is, do you read into it that a broader correction is coming after what has been a really big win streak led by tech?
I mean, there's obviously a pullback waiting for us somewhere. I think we have been building toward a level of common complacency and technical, extended.
Well, there's been a lot more enthusiasm in this earnings season, and I do wonder at what point we're going to start to question whether it's been justified.
That's right.
Based on the question I asked you at the beginning, which is, you know, multiples clearly seem to be moving somewhat higher. And of course, as we talk so many times, you know, whether it's NVIDIA, Microsoft, sure, or Meta, but once you get beyond a handful of names, is it going to actually show up in the numbers, this enthusiasm around, for example, generative AI, which is going to play out over a long period of time?
The counter to that is, if you're complaining about the concentration of the market and you're complaining about valuation, you're complaining about the same thing. Because the concentration of the very largest stocks, which are very expensive, is kind of driving up the multiple. The other piece of it is, and this is something that, for example, Savita Subramanian over at B of A has been pointing out for a couple of months, is the market's acting the way it does when earnings trough, which means it broadens out, and you get a valuation rebuild. People keep saying, oh, the whole rally this year is multiple expansion. Exactly. The first move in a bull market is always valuation expansion.
And she expects it to continue, this note just out from today.
Yes, exactly. So she does expect it to continue. I think that's the bull case. Now, that means that if we keep broadening...
That's also, by the way, evidenced by small caps rallying the way they are. Big evidence that you're kind of at the floor. And remember, stocks bottom like 6 to 7 months before the bottom in earnings, per Goldman Sachs. Actually, 6 to 9 months, but that's about, you know, December. Crazy to now.
What still seems like it might be a headwind, and things like speculation in options, individual stock options, and things like that are getting overheated. Individual investor mood is brightening, and by the surveys, although I would argue flows into equity funds have not yet gotten to that red alert type of level of excitement.
I think there's the retail frenzy, which is back a little bit, which we should talk about. The meme stocks doing well, the serious move that we saw yesterday. But just in general, on earnings,
It may have been more a short squeeze and technically related to this rebalancing, the serious move. That was crazy, that 42%
crazy
move in serious.
It just reminded you a little bit of
right
meme days.
It did.
As it relates to earnings, one theme, though, and potential headwind that people have been looking out for is this idea that, yes, we're in a disinflationary environment now, so that could potentially hurt margins and performance of some companies. We've seen that a little bit overseas with Volvo and Electrolux. I think there are questions about Ford, for instance, reducing pricing on the F-150. A little bit Netflix, too, maybe a little hint of that in that, and whether that's a big enough theme, Mike, to suggest that maybe earnings have not troughed.
Yeah, or at least maybe the estimates for latter half of this year and next year are still too high. I mean, which often is the case a year ahead. I mean, almost always is the case, as a matter of fact. I do think it's definitely relevant in some pockets. And I think it's also keeping a lot of companies from getting aggressive on guidance. They're no longer trying to build in and assume better pricing. I do have to step back 1 second and laugh, because the pattern of this year has been whatever good thing the market seizes upon immediately becomes a bear story. So inflation's coming down.
Right.
Markets like that. But be careful what it does to earnings. We got a debt ceiling deal. We didn't default on the debt. But be careful. Treasury's going to have to sell a lot of debt to rebuild the cash balance. So I do think that that's almost a healthy instinct that people have of just not assuming things are going to be great. And we keep riding that pattern for now. That being said, yeah, we're getting aggressive in terms of valuation. Yeah. I don't think valuation's number one, two, or three are the reasons you should like this market.
Right. When it comes to deflation, Sarah, longer term, I mean, I'm sure you hear it, I do as well, the impact of generative AI and what that's going to mean, not near term, not this quarter or next, but over the next 5, 10 years. Yeah, over the next 3 to 5 years even, because it is moving fairly quickly. It comes up all the time. You know, I think even CEO conversations, what jobs might I be able to replace at some point with this technology? And that's sort of, I mean, everybody's trying to understand the power of it and how it can be used. There is, I don't know how you quantify that over a long period of time.
Nobody's able to do that yet, but obviously if you're able to save money and productivity and all of that, that ultimately is deflationary, also deals with a tight labor market that we've been having. But the problem now is the opposite. It's that wages have risen and that it's hard to get workers. And
we have risen.
AI story in terms of the deflation or even the disinflation story, because it's not there yet. Although comments like Arvind Krishna a few months ago at IBM saying that they're able to replace a lot of office functionality, what did he say, 30% of it with AI? It's pretty striking. Yeah. And if he said that out loud, you know other companies, and they're advising and consulting with other companies to be doing that as well. So clearly a profound effect that nobody fully understands.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it comes up, you know, in my world, for example, how many junior bankers are we going to be able to replace one day? Those who just basically do nothing but produce decks and models at this point. That said, of course, I'm not sure how you make senior bankers if you'd have no junior bankers to start with.
Right. Well, I think absolutely impossible to quantify, but as an overlay on everybody's thinking. To me, where I come down on it is, it shows you that the disinflationary effect of technology that we've enjoyed for decades has not been repealed, perhaps, which is different than what people were saying 2 years ago, where you had, you know, global supply chains maxed out, structural labor shortages, this idea that we could have the risk of 70s-style kind of chronic inflation and big outbursts of it. And we still could, of course. Who knows? But I think it does push against that idea to some degree.
But right now, the inflection point is more about all the spending for compute power to actually create these generative models that may one day bring this disinflation.
But the more immediate question is, and for industry groups like semiconductors, the debate is it enough to push against the downturn that we're expecting in the end market and the cycle that you would normally see in semiconductors right now? I think TSMC poured a little bit of cold water on that yesterday, which is why we saw the stock down. But for a stock like NVIDIA or an AMD, sure, when you're really exposed, you're not getting the kind of weakness that you might normally see in this period of the economic cycle.
No.
TSM's down because of macro. This is true, but we expected that, and mostly anyway. That there's a limit. I mean, you can't turn all your factories all of a sudden into, that's it, all we're doing is AI chips. You know, they're still making the 20-plus nanometer chips all day long that you need in your washing machine and all your other crap.
ECB meeting, which we're expecting a hike, and we get a Bank of Japan meeting.
Wow, there's so much going on. One would expect Sarah Eisen's going to have quite a week. Except
there's a
that,
lot going on.
Except that I don't know that that's going to be the
Monday,
case.
I'm here Monday and Tuesday.
Oh, you're here Monday and Tuesday?
Don't worry. I'll set it up for you so that
please.
You can take
wow.
the ball.
Please, yeah.
Off of
yeah.
Day.
Yeah, I know. As a-
oh, I love their banter. It's great. Okay, but there's a limit to how much we can listen to it. Okay, so I love that they're talking. They actually made a piece, comment on the bear pieces. But Kevin, what about liquidity? Okay, let's knock this. This one's just annoying to me. Like, I'm sorry. This piece we got to talk about is just annoying. I don't want to talk about it, but I'm pissed because people keep asking me about this damn FedNow crap. Everybody's like, but Kevin, maybe the bears are dead, but now they're going to steal all our money with FedNow. Oh my God. FedNow. Now everybody's just going to go, Kevin's just a shill. I knew it. He's a paid shill. I knew he was a Fed boy. That's where he got that New York Stock Exchange vest from. Ever since he launched an ETF, he turned into a shill. Oh my Lord. The amount of people freaking out about wrong picture, about this, is stupid. People were freaking out about FedNow, which was officially launched yesterday. Let me first give you a little bit of background on this and then talk about this. FedNow was launched yesterday. It was launched for development in 2020 to speed up payments and transfers between a sender and a receiver to make them essentially 24/7 instant, nearly instantaneous. Okay? That's it. So, in other words, think of it kind of like Apple Pay, except rather than going through an intermediary like Apple, it just goes through your bank. Or think about it like Zelle. It's like a quick, high limit, low to no fee, instantaneous payment system like Zelle. That officially launched yesterday. Now, when you actually go to your bank, like JP Morgan, who is a FedNow partner, which maybe I did yesterday, and I'm like, yo, your website says you guys offer FedNow. It says contact JP Morgan to become a client to get FedNow. I happen to be a JP Morgan client. So I'm like, yo, give me some FedNow. And they're like, we're not ready yet. Like, you all suck. So anyway, like, there's still time before you're actually going to practically see this show up in your life. I would expect it's practically going to take probably to the end of the year to actually get FedNow more popularly popping up around your banks. And you see a little sign, FedNow or whatever. It's just a payment system. The people who are freaking out over this are like, oh my God, the feds are going to take control of your money. And they're going to see all the money that you spend. And then they're going to freeze your bank account. Damn right they're going to freeze your bank account if you're a dumbass criminal. And you're so much of a dumbass criminal that you're actually using the banking system, you deserve to get your crap frozen. Now, I get it. I know then some people are like, but Kevin, this is just going to lead to a CBDC, and we're going to have a central bank digital currency, and then they're going to be able to control everything that we do, and then they're going to make us pay taxes on tipping people, and they're going to get rid of cash. Okay. Those things may end up happening in the future. There is a high likelihood that at some point in the future, we won't get to use cash anymore. Yes, it sucks. It means we don't have to carry around cash anymore that we end up losing. We don't have to go to the bank anymore to lose cash. We don't have to go to stupid ATMs and pay ridiculous fees to pick up cash. And people are going to be like, but Kevin, how am I going to tip the door person? Don't get me wrong. I like tipping too. I like getting literally $2 bills. In fact, I got a whole stack of them right here. This is, by the way, a great life hack. You have to go to your bank and get a stack of these Federal Reserve notes. all $2 bills. I like the smell of it. It's kind of cool because the government can't see what you buy with it. I get it. Don't worry. You'll have plenty of time left for you to still use your cash to buy the shady shit you want to buy. There'll be plenty of time left for that. It ain't going away anytime soon. Might not even happen in our lifetimes that cash goes away. But at some point in the future, cash will go away. But don't worry. You'll have plenty of time. And FedNow ain't going to make a lick of a difference to your life. So if you're like, you know, being all shady or whatever and you want your cash, but... or you just want to leverage the power of the $2 bill, consider that if you wanted to give a door person a $5 bill, if instead you gave them two crisp $2 bills, every time you do that, you would be saving 20% on your tipping, yet the person would feel like they got even more than $5. See? Psychology of money. Who thought you would click on a FedNow video to think the world is collapsing and you're screwed, only to hear that you should get $2 bills. Anyway, quite frankly, I don't think there's a simpler way to put it. The fear over FedNow is complete bullcrap, whatever. And even when we go to, you know, like even if we were just using Bitcoin to transact or Ethereum to transact, the reality is all that would end up happening is the IRS will go to all of us and go, what's your Ethereum wallet address? And then they'll find all your wallet addresses, and then you'll have the transparent blockchain, which ends up being even more revealing than what you're able to do now. Right now, at least there's some secrecy over what you're spending your money on with your credit or debit card. You don't actually have that on the blockchain once people are aware of your wallet address. Now, sure, you can tornado cash and all that. I get it. But look, what I thought was really fascinating about this is that yesterday the Wall Street Journal was actually talking about how the launch of the FedNow service might actually eliminate the need for a CBDC at all. So in other words, all the people who are like, oh my gosh, the FedNow service is just a step towards a central bank digital currency, we're screwed. The FedNow service might end up being so damn good. So good, and not because the Fed made it. It's because, guess what the Fed did? They called up the banks. They're like, yo, Citi, Wells, B of A, JP Morgan. Y'all, starting to compete a little bit here with the cryptos. Why don't y'all make a system that's even better, potentially? And whether or not it's better, you know, I'm not trying to bag on crypto here. I'm just saying, whether or not it is better or isn't better, private enterprise worked in conjunction with the Fed, which I understand might sound scary. Probably to some extent is. Yeah, I'm going to get a lot of comments like, you just don't know, Kevin. You're only 31. You don't even know. Whatever, man. So people are going to realize, in my opinion, that we're not going to do wires anymore. Like, this will replace dumbass wires, stupid ACH transactions, wires which people freak out about because they have to go to the bank and verify all these numbers, and you can't get your money back if you send it the wrong place, or if you mess up the address of the recipient person, like you get the bank account routing number right, but you mess up the address, the wire goes into limbo for a few weeks before it gets returned, and it's a complete disaster. Or you send an ACH, it takes like 3 days to show up, unless you want to pay extra money, of course, and then it'll show up within one business day. Or you want to go get a physical check. Oh, okay, yeah, because you really want to go drive somewhere to either go deliver or pick up a check, or worse, put a stamp on it and mail it. Come on, man. All this old crap, wires, ACH, checks, it's all lame, crap, garbage, old school payments. Okay, so what about online bill pay? You're still waiting 5 to 7 days for the check to show up. Okay, well, what about Zelle? $5,000 limit. Now, you might be going, bro, Kevin, man, the limits on Venmo and Zelle, this is good, man. I don't need any more than that. What are you talking about? And I'm like, bro, run a business and try to pay your bills with Zelle. You will hit the limit every time you sit down. It sucks. FedNow could solve that. So it actually makes businesses more efficient. When businesses become more efficient, they spend less time on money, on accounting, and all the BS. And you actually create businesses that are more resilient to well, going bankrupt in the future, but also let them be more profitable, which allow them to pay their employees more. And I know this is where people go, you say just because the business can make more money, they're going to pay their more employees more. That is generally what happens. As the economy makes more money, people's real incomes do rise over time. And so this massive blow up of fear over Fed now is just like, I'm tired of hearing about it. Like, if anything, we might not even need a CBDC anymore. So the slippery slope fears are completely garbage. And I'm personally actually very excited to start using this because I'm tired of all the other crap, especially since we've got the Reg A coming up. We have officially filed, by the way, with the SEC. Hint, hint, if you go to sec.gov and you type in house hack under filings, you might actually see a filing there now. Finally freaking filed. But anyway, so I'll be raising money for that. And I'm like, well, we could receive money through wire, check, ACH, or credit card. And I'm like, all of those suck ass. If we could get Fed now, oh my gosh, instant money basically for free that way. It'd be easier for you. It'd be easier for us. It'd be fantastic. So, you know, from an institutional money point of view, I'm like, please, more of this, not less of this. Like, I'm tired of the old crap that we use. Again, this isn't trying to say, like, oh, you know, bow down to the government. I don't really, just, like, honestly, they shouldn't have labeled it FedNow. That's stupid. You know what they should have done? They should have labeled it BankNow. You know, like, or MoneyNow. The fact that they labeled it FedNow is so stupid. That's where they went wrong. And I get it. They're like, But it's like the Fed's clearing services. So you know, if the Fed now, the Fed is the one who validates the messaging and does the clearing, then you know it should be called Fed. No, you dummies. People don't want to be associated with the Feds. You go to any, I guarantee you this. You go to any bar in America, and you walk in. I don't have glasses here. You walk in with a black suit and a black tie, and you put some black glasses on like you're a Men in Black or whatever, and you're like, it's the Feds. Everybody's pissed. Everybody's gonna be like, oh shit, what's, oh man, I don't like this person. What's that suit doing in here? You know, it's like, you don't go to a bar wearing a suit. Mainstream America doesn't want to deal with the Feds. We don't want the Feds in our lives. We just want to be left alone. We just want to work hard, make our money, spend time with our family, and just leave us the hell alone. That's America. That's a good thing. So calling it Fed now is really dumb. And I think it really like plays into the whole like insanity fears that people have over this. And it's really stupid. So anyway, that's my take on Fed now. Thank you very much. All right, what's next? Let's take a look at what's going on here in El pre-marketo. Hey, ooh, you know, if the markets rise right at open, I wonder if it's call option time. You know what we're going to do? In the course member live, let's look at some implied volatility going into the opening bell and see if there's some juicy opportunities to pick up some calls after yesterday's crazy ass sell down of nonsense. Yeah. So let's do that. So, with that said, make sure to check out the programs on Building Your Wealth link down below. You can now shadow me as well. We are already booking out to like September, October-ish. So like we're almost done with the year already. Probably will be within the next 4 or 5 days when that coupon expires on the 26th. Email us with questions at staff@meetkevin.com gets you a faster response. And thank you so much for being here, watching, listening. We'll see you in the next one.